people being taught different things? Are they taught about the same thing in a different way? Therefore, the people have a different view and understanding of what reality is all about, because it was taught to them in a different way from what it really is.
Oh, did you see them chanting for them soldiers? Some of them and go fight a dirty one, oh yeah. They want to control with violence. In them battle for the seven seas, brimstone and thunder shall surely.
Bye. thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Does U.S. Military Intervention in the Middle East Help or Hurt? You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And that is our motion, flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. And our final opening statement will be against this motion. I'd like to welcome Mike Duran. He's a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served as senior director for the Near East and North Africa at the National Security Council. Please welcome Mike Duran.
Look, it's true that we have to have wise use of force as opposed to dumb use of force. I think we can all agree to that. If we're going to say, though, that we need to have a kind of bias in favor of restraint, then you're saying one of two things. You're saying that military action is either going to destroy some beneficial process that is ongoing, or you're saying that it is going to generate some new bad process that doesn't exist. And I think that that proposition, the proposition basically that Paul laid out, is the one that President Obama accepted when he took office in 2009. And I look at the last 5 years as a kind of referendum on that proposition, and I think it comes up faulty. And I'd like to explain to you why. So what do we see over the last 5 years? We saw, first of all, in Iraq, we saw the Maliki government become increasingly sectarian, increasingly dependent on Iraq, and increasingly dictatorial. Now, Paul said that the surge did not stop the civil war. It just lowered the violence a little bit. It's not true. The surge created a political space that Maliki could have used to have created a more inclusive government. It needed, though, continued American pressure, which the Obama administration would not apply. That's what was happening in Iraq. So the civil war started up again. Meanwhile, in Syria, another civil war started, which had nothing to do whatsoever with the application of American force. It started completely as a result of indigenous processes. But there, too, we have a sectarian Shiite government aligned with Iran that is destroying Sunnis. Now, think about the extent of the destruction in Syria. Syria is a country of around 20 million people. 9 million of them, possibly even 10 million of them, are now displaced. That's almost half the entire population of the country has been displaced. 3 million of them have been driven out of Syria and are now refugees in the surrounding countries, risking to destabilize those countries. So if you want to say that using military force is going to stop some kind of beneficial process that is ongoing, you can't make the argument. Because if you look at what's happening, the Middle East is spiraling out of control. And that's why President Obama finally had to apply force, because there was this process spiraling out of force. Now, Paul Pillar said something interesting. He said, you can't make people increase their will by use of military force. This is patently not true. The fact of the matter is that what we have in the Middle East are countries run by mafias or organizations like ISIS that are first and foremost mafia organizations. If somebody goes to the United States and beheads its citizens on television, and the United States says, I'm not going to do anything, it sends a message to all of our allies in the region that if we're not going to go take action when our citizens are beheaded, we're certainly not going to come help them. If we don't put skin in the game, and skin in the game means military force, then we will undermine the will of our allies whom we need. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael Duran. And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. Now on to round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. We have heard from each of the teams now, two teams of two. The team arguing for the motion, Paul Pillar and Aaron David Miller, made a presentation in which they said they are not against all use of force all of the time. They are against the use of force in a dumb way, that force has a downside, and that downside is unintended consequences that have caused costs. They ran through situations in history where this has already occurred, most recently Iraq. The team arguing against the motion, Michael Doran and Brett Stevens, argue themselves. They say that inaction also has unintended consequences, and they say also that that has been seen in the disintegration of Iraq and in the creation of ISIS. They also make a case based on history. So what we want to do is go look at some of these specifics, because we all know what we're talking about. We're talking about where do we go from here and what's happened in the recent past. And I want to look at the fact that President Obama did indeed take a relatively restrained view on the situation in Syria and Iraq until August of 2014. And that makes me want to ask the side that's arguing for the motion. Was the president once on your side on this argument, and then he switched to the other side? Aaron David Miller.
Again, we're constrained and confined by a motion that is, in many respects, really not appropriate to the national conversation that has to be had. This president is risk-averse, except in one area, where he has emerged to be George W. Bush on steroids. And that is the protection of the continental United States. He's killed 10 times the number of terrorists, militants, extremists with predator drones. He's expanded the drone war to Pakistan, to Yemen, to Somalia. He killed bin Laden. He dismantled Al-Qaeda.
So, but let me stop you before you go too far down that road, because I think we see where you're going. So are you saying that he has been a muscle flexor and that it has not made things worse?
What I'm saying is the reason he interceded is because the organizing principle of a nation's foreign policy is the protection of the homeland. 9/11 was the second bloodiest day in American history. That is the organizing principle. That's why public opinion, frankly, has become risk-ready. Not because we believe or the president believes that he is somehow going to put the Iraqi and Syrian Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Folks, please welcome Alaska Governor and Vice Presidential Hopeful Sarah Palin.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Now, I know that some of you don't really think that I have the qualifications to be the next Vice President of the United States. But I am here to assure you that unlike Senator Obama, who has never worn the crown and sash of a beauty pageant contestant, I have had to answer the tough questions. Some of them involving world peace. Now, as governor of Alaska for a year and a half, you know, that's a long time. I could have popped out two babies in that time. And before that, mayor of Wasilla, which I won in a landslide election, by the way. I got both votes. I have come to understand what the American people care about. For instance, housing. I know that all across America, people are worried that their mortgage will go into foreclosure and they will lose their igloo. It's tough, people, it's tough. Now also, sex education. I know it's on the minds of many parents who do not want to follow the Democrats in their path to hell. Now, if you watch the Republican convention, you know that part of our platform is promoting abstinence among teenagers. Going really well in the lower 48 states. So, as you know and can see, I have all the qualifications necessary to be the next Vice President of the United States, even though I don't have the foggiest idea what they actually do. So to help me out with a few pointers, please welcome Vice President Dick Cheney.
What are you laughing at? Mrs. Palin, it's good to see you. I hope you're ready to be the spare tire on the car that is the United States of America. I'm sure you'll do just fine. You won't have any problems working for hopefully, President McCain. At least it'll be easier than I've had to deal with. I'm sure your president won't get locked in the bathroom or get his tie stuck in his desk drawer every day for 8 frickin' years.
Mr. Vice President, how do you think I should deal with environmental issues?
Just stick to the Republican playbook, and I'm sure you'll be just fine.
I don't think I'll have any problem with that.
Strip mines on hillsides and parks filled with derricks.
Clear cutting gives those tree huggers hysterics.
So many smokestacks it makes your eyes sting. These are the things favored by the right wing.
What should we do with the birds and the fishes?
I find bald eagle is rather delicious.
Alternative energy must be somewhere.
We'll try to trap Nancy Pelosi's hot air. If we ask to drill Alaska,
voters might get mad. Once they pay $2 a gallon for gas, well, then they won't feel so bad.
The drills are alive, but we made the moose sick. My God, woman, you just shot that moose in the face.
Oh, I thought he was an elderly lawyer. Wink, wink.
My God, you're sexy. I haven't been this turned on since ever. Let's destroy the earth so it's just you and me left together.
Dick Cheney, I'm with you. In fact, I am you with lipstick.
Ha, 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 ha.
Mine every mountain, fill every stream, level every hillside, everything that's green.
Drill some new oil wells on Mount Rushmore instead, 'cause we might find some oil if we drill Lincoln's head.
And now, back to the debate. Does U.S. military intervention in the Middle East help or hurt?
I don't think go to Brett Stevens.
He can't.
Brett Stevens.
Let me, you know, Aaron said something very interesting somewhere in his talk. He said, I think towards the end. He said, we have to find some middle ground between the overambitions of the freedom agenda, of the Bush doctrine, and perhaps the lack of ambition of what was the first 5 years of the Obama presidency. What is the Goldilocks formula? That's essentially, you would agree with me, that's what we're looking to do. And let me make two brief suggestions. One of them is this. The purpose of American foreign policy should not be, particularly in the Middle East, should not be to make our dreams come true, because your dreams will never come true when it comes to the Middle East. Not Israel-Palestine, not democracy in Iraq, not development in Afghanistan, not gay rights in Iran, and so on. However, we can have an achievable goal of keeping our nightmares at bay. We don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon. We don't want ISIS to consolidate a caliphate in northern Iraq and Syria. We don't want the humanitarian disaster of Syria to spiral endlessly and affect all of its neighbors. Okay. How do we calibrate a foreign policy that keeps our nightmares at bay? That is the question.
Let's let Paul Pillick respond.
You know, Brett's absolutely right that we can't think in terms of what our dreams are in the Middle East. And that's exactly part of what Aaron and I are criticizing. Again, Iraq 2003, the outstanding example, 2003 plus 8.5 years, we had a dream, or at least the makers of that war had a dream, of using the regime change in this central Middle Eastern state to stimulate free market economics and democracy, not just in Iraq, but throughout the region. It was trying to use military force to accomplish a more positive objective. And that's one of the ways we went wrong. You know, meeting real threats, absolutely. And Brett gave a couple of excellent examples in his initial presentation, but it's where we've gone beyond meeting threats.
Paul, what about the example he gave of the Yazidi community stuck on the top of a mountain facing genocide? That's not a threat to our national security. Was it our business militarily?
Well, it was a threat to the Yazidis. And yeah. I think there are some, you know, very tactical decisions that have been very difficult for the administration to make, and we can get really down in the weeds in terms of, you know, hitting this mountain rather than that mountain. And I don't think Aaron and I are saying, despite the efforts of our worthy opponents to, you know, frame the debate in a way that we have to say that every use of military force is for the worst. That's, of course, not what we're
Aaron?
Saying.
Yeah, may I just try to frame this? Look, we are stuck in a region we cannot transform and we cannot extricate ourselves from. That leaves only one course, which is, I would argue, my word, you transact. You decide what's doable from what isn't, what is vital from what is discretionary. And when I say vital, what do I mean by vital? I mean an enterprise in which we are prepared to expend American lives, American treasure, and American credibility.
Mike Turan.
I just want to make one point here about the importance of using military force. If we don't show a bias toward action, then we won't have allies. We were accustomed, as a result of the kind of rhetoric that we heard from Paul, to think that when we use military force, we alienate people. It's not true. Why the people in the Middle East want us primarily for one thing, and that is our ability to provide security. Look at Syria today. If we want to solve Syria, or if we just want to make it a little bit better and keep it at a distance, we want to put others out in front. We want to have allies. We would like to have Turkey, one of the most important countries there, go and do things in Syria.
Well,
They're not going to go out and take risks in Turkey if they think that we might do like President Obama did a year ago with Syria and say, you know what, I'm tired of this fight. They need to know we're going to go all the way with them and back them no matter what happens,
okay.
And that requires military
force. Paul Pillar, very good argument made by your opponents about our credibility, which was put up in opposition to your saying that we make enemies by getting in there, and they're saying at least we're keeping allies by going in and showing strength consistently. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, one of the big myths about credibility is that any time we back away from something that's either a losing proposition or not worth the effort, that somehow people and governments all over the world are going to think, oh, the Americans are a bunch of weak-kneed people who aren't going to stand up to their vital interests. That is simply not the case, and there's academic research on this, that's not the way that other governments think or perceive us.
Brett Stevens.
Look, what Paul said is just simply manifestly untrue. I think Paul and I would agree that we do not want Israel to attack Iran in the event that Iran or the Israelis perceive that Iran is approaching a nuclear capability, some point of no return. But when we show, when we tell the Israelis, when we announce that we have a red line in Syria, and then we erase that red line, and the president goes before the cameras and says, oh, I never said red line. The world had a red line. It was someone else's red line. And by the way, I have this interesting diplomatic gambit that I've worked out with Sergei Lavrov. What does that tell decision makers in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv? It tells them that America's promise that it will not allow Iran to get nuclear weapons is a totally hollow promise that they cannot trust, and you don't have to take my word for it. You can ask the Israeli defense minister, who is on record as saying this. Same story with the Saudis. We used to have a close defense alliance with the Saudis. The Saudis don't trust us anymore, which is why John Kerry had to go on bended knee to Riyadh a few weeks ago to say, no, this time we're actually serious.
Point made, and I want to take it down, David Miller.
What I'm about to say is my view. We have spent the last several years trying to preempt the Israelis from striking Iran prematurely on the assumption that negotiations and or sanctions, some combination of the two, would retard, ultimately undermine Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapons capacity. Forget the weapon itself, just the threshold capacity. We have made commitments to the Israelis based on the assumption that if they stay their hand and Iran moves to weaponize, we will do this. This president may well be called on, Brett, to make good on that.
Nobody in the Middle East believes he'll actually do that. He said it, or he's signaled it, suggested it, and so on. But there is nobody in Riyadh, nobody in Jerusalem, nobody in Baghdad, and nobody in Tehran believes that he will actually use military force to stop Iran.
Remember back in Amman, they found the money was gone. So you fled from the country as fast as you could, and you found with some valuable friends. Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz knew you were ready to swim. So you made up a whale of a deal for a hell of a deal. Chalabi, oh, Chalabi, oh, reasons. Now you claim to be heroes in error, dismissing the reasons you gave us for war. And you offer to fall on your sword like the prodigal lord. But the troops and civilians who died for your cause deserve more. Chalabi, oh, Chalabi, oh.
And now for something completely different.